Well, the Air Force is said to be getting ready to wave goodbye to the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. You know it as HAARP. This according to the Anchorage Daily News. And, of course, Nick Begich, he's an Alaskan. He'll tell us what's going on. Now, unlike last year's rumors about the project's demise, well, this time it appears to be for real, we think. Let's check in with Nick Begich in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Nick Begich, well known for his work and research on HAARP, regular guest here on Coast to Coast AM, author of a number of books, Controlling the Human Mind, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, Earth Rising, and a DVD series, as well as website, earthpulse.com, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Who better to react to this apparent story that the Air Force is ready to pull the plug on HAARP? Nick, is this a true story?
Well, it is in the paper. It actually, that story ran Thursday, May 15th in our local paper. And what they say is essentially that they're done. They've completed the mission, is what they're saying. In fact, I'll quote from it. It says, we're moving on to other ways of managing the ionosphere, which the HAARP was really designed to do, unquote. It says, and then it goes on, to inject energy into the atmosphere to be able to actually control it, but that work has been completed, unquote. What they're really saying is, as far as the Air Force is concerned, they've proven they can manipulate the ionosphere, control it with this technology, and apparently there's something better, and they don't want to invest any more money in this. But, I kind of question whether it really will shut down. It's a $290 million investment at this point. It's being used by a lot of academic institutions and others. What they need to keep it operating is about $3 to $5 million a year. And it wouldn't surprise me to see either international or other governmental contracts that provided a way for this facility to stay open. I would be surprised if it actually does shut down. And if it does, I would question really how long that will be. It's a big facility. That's a lot of money. You don't usually see programs dropping it. But the Air Force actually announced this over a year ago, and DARPA picked it up for the last year, so it kept going another year, and we may see that kind of patched together funding for HAARP. So I don't know. The story reads like the last one. Maybe they've got a better way, but at the same time, you've got one of the guys involved from the very early days, Dennis Papadopoulos, put a piece in our commentary part of the paper on the 22nd, and he was really making the case for why it ought to continue to operate. So who knows? On a federal level, I don't think so. I don't think necessarily to see a direct funding of this thing, and the intention is probably to shut it down. But we'll see between now and the end of the federal fiscal year. If they actually shut it down, I'll be quite surprised, actually.
HAARP basically helped you get on the map with Angels Don't Play This HAARP, didn't it?
Oh yeah, for sure. It was the first book that that I published with Gene Manning on, on new technologies, and HAARP was a part of that. In fact, we got into some of the other technologies we've covered over the years at that same time. But yeah, HAARP was a place where I really started this work. In fact, it was December of, I think, 95, maybe 96, that we were on with Coast to Coast the first time. And it was right after we published in, I think it was, September 95. So it would have been December 95 we were on with Coast the first time and took this issue out to the public. And, and it's been, 18 years? Maybe almost 20 now. So, since the first stuff we started writing on this topic. So it's been a full federal cycle, I suppose, as programs go for the Air Force. But again, it's been used by a lot of other people. We'll see what really happens here. But, it wouldn't surprise me if there's better technology out. Because what we were talking about then and is this whole idea of this change in technology and what it's doing, and the idea of even being able to control this area of our environment, the ionosphere, and having figured out ways to do that for all of the purposes that we've covered over the years, the defense applications, as well as some of the more sinister kind of ideas that are floating around and that are really borne out by the science. And I think that's what, when we think about HAARP, it kind of became sort of the hallmark for all things suspect in terms of new technologies. But there's many technologies. I mean, think about the privacy-related technologies that have been disclosed over the last 10, 15 years by others. If you look at just all of it in terms of the direction in which our sort of war machine goes. It is a dramatic and big change. HAARP was certainly a part of that.
Would you be surprised if they publicly came out and told us what HAARP really did?
You know, at this stage, probably not, because, you know, at least now I think more people recognize the technologies as they exist, and there's been a lot of good independent work, you know, done by many, and you know, the amount of research and money that's been spent in these areas, I think, you know, is pretty much become better and better known as time's gone on, a little more transparent in that sense. But yeah, I think the idea of some of the bigger concepts, you know, the weather control issues, the idea of generating earthquakes or understanding them even, these are the areas of big science in the 21st century, and HAARP was a part of that. Those concepts, when you look at the very inception, the idea of utilizing energy as a weapons technology by coupling with natural energy forces within the planet, those were all pretty, you know, pretty leading edge technologies, and you hear a lot more about that over the last couple of decades.
All right, let's get into some of this, Nick. And how did you first start with the HAARP? What happened? What did you hear? Of course, you're from Alaska.
Right.
It's in Alaska. Is that how that started?
No, actually, I read an article in Nexus magazine, and I traced it back to, it was quoting an article in the Anchorage Daily News, which turned out to be just a letter to the editor, and that's what caught my interest initially. And then we looked at, you know, what had already been done on this. You know, what had the other environmental organizations been doing? What did the government say they were doing out there? And from there, the first article I wrote was 94, and then that brought me in contact with Gene, and we decided there was a lot more to say about this technology and the, sort of the general direction in which technology was headed, and Angels Don't Play This HAARP was the book that really did that.
Nick, you have theorized several things about HAARP and that it could be used for weather modification.
Right.
Some people believe mind control.
Right.
You wrote a book called Controlling the Human
Right.
Mind. There are other HAARPs throughout the planet, though, right?
It's right, not, right.
It wasn't just in Alaska.
Right, that's correct. And what it's really about is pulse modulated signals, which any carrier can use for carrying signals. And you know, that whole concept, that's why HAARP was so interesting from the inception. Is early writers, Zbigniew Brzezinski, J.F. Gordon MacDonald at UCLA, and others were talking about, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, we could control behavior over huge geographic areas. And HAARP became a tool that could actually do exactly what they were suggesting and bring back this ELF, or extremely low signal, that would create what's called a frequency falling response, which is where the brain locks onto this external signal and begins to mirror it. And that changes emotional states over big areas, and that's what these guys were talking about. And eventually you had a system big enough to do exactly that, and in certain applications, as even a side effect, would accomplish that. And that's HAARP.
What about the possibility that they truly, you know, wanted to use this for some kind of warfare? Possible?
Oh yeah, I mean, from the standpoint of both, you know, when you think about what it was designed for, I mean, it was designed as a surveillance technology, as a technology that could be used for earth-penetrating tomography, as a technology that could be used at a high enough power as an anti-missile technology, being able to first detect over the horizon, even over the horizon missiles at very low altitudes, and then be able to determine which of those are carrying nuclear payloads that had the capability of creating energy fields around those incoming objects could be then measured with satellite technology to determine which ones carried nuclear payloads, and then at a high enough power level be used for creating an EMP, which would be like a pulse of energy sufficient to disrupt the onboard avionics or electrical controls on the incoming object, so it would malfunction and crash. So, you know, even in the basic stuff in the original patents of Bernard Eastland, the military, straight-on military applications are pretty clear. And that's why it was originally funded by the Air Force and Navy, and then later almost exclusively by DARPA, although a lot of academic institutions were doing independent research utilizing HAARP as well.
some publications when the story came out, Nick, about its possible closing, started taking pot shots at people who have theorized, you, me, and other people, that the heart may be used for other purposes. And they said, well, you people can be happy now. You don't have to worry about mind control and bad weather manipulation and things like that.
Well,
I don't think they get it, do they?
No, and you know, HARP is just one technology, and anyone who's read our work, and unfortunately, most people that report on it have never read it. You know, I get more interviews by people who've never even looked at the material. But you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of source documents quoted. Most of them are the military's own records or academic studies, and the things that really support not just what we were saying about HARP, but the direction of the technologies generally. And when you look at the trends in the technology that we've reported on now for 20 years, we've been right. I mean, take a look at Earth, Rise, and Revolution in terms of what we said about privacy-related technology in 1999 and 2000 are the very same things you read on the front page of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal in 2013, 2014. And it wasn't by speculation or being able to read into a crystal ball. It was just by compiling what had been published thus far and, you know, kind of looking at where the government was headed with some of this stuff. And you could pretty well see it coming. The thing is reporting it in 2013 and 2014 doesn't help us much. Reporting it in 1999 might have avoided a lot of it. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that what we said about HARP, we still maintain. I mean, those are the things that it can do. The thing about it is, and we've said it over and over again, is it's just one system that can create a pulse modulation that can couple with the human body. You can use any carrier, radio, TV, internet, power grids can be even modulated to do this. And there's some great stuff that we've quoted over the years. The Mind Has No Firewalls, which is put together by the U.S. Army War College Quarterly, and the winner of 98 is a great article that people can still find on the web. But there's a lot of really important issues as they relate to technologies that are either not reported on or extremely underreported on. And by the time they finally make it in the paper, 20 years have gone by and lots of new things have come and gone. I don't believe HARP will necessarily close even at this location, but there are many transmitters around the world that have the same capabilities today that HARP had in its inception. Maybe not the versatility of this instrument, but certainly the capability of carrying this science forward.
Nick, let's spend some time, up to the break, and then for the rest of this hour, we'll take calls next hour, of course. But your work on controlling the human mind, I have always found that work alone, one of the most fascinating books I've read. Let's get into that too.
You bet.
What do you think has been going on over the last 15, 20 years with this?
Well, you know, a lot. In fact, if you just read again the open literature and think about what's been what's come out, you know, the idea, one of the big stories that we've all heard about is the idea of dealing with traumatized war veterans, you know, to be able to knock out memory. And this is the way it's being sold in any case. But when you think about what that entails, think about the idea of being able to go into a person's mind, their consciousness, and being able to alter it in such a way that they couldn't distinguish a given memory set from one they actually experientially had, or to have one they really had and have it just taken away from them. I don't know that that's really the domain of government, and I think most people would tend to agree, and this is what's out there in the open literature. Now, the guys is, well, we're going to help these traumatized vets, but you know, maybe there's something, you know, as horrible as all that is, but maybe there's something that we need to remember in this. If war becomes something that creates no pain at all, it becomes much easier to wage. And when we start to remove ourselves from the battlefield, something we've been talking about for a very long time, and now we are seeing more and more of that, whether with drones or sort of remote-controlled warfare. Mm-hmm. But as we withdraw from that, our sensitivity to what all that means and what that entails for future generations as it becomes easier to wage war. I think that's the thing that we lose in this. And knocking out memory sets, who decides what what you remember then and what you forget. I don't like that. That just hits me the wrong way. For someone who's been in government for my whole life and my family has for a couple of generations, that scares the heck out of me.
Nick, isn't controlling the human mind also done with, like that color scheme during 9/11 where condition yellow, condition right. red, and stuff like that? Isn't that controlling the human mind?
Oh, on all kinds of levels. I mean, just think of basic propaganda, is certainly that. Injecting fear. I mean, the simplest way to control a population is you keep them in a constant state of fear and worry. And the reason it works so well is you can't reach your higher ordered thinking. And if you actually measure this, your brainwave activity, you would see in that constant state of worry or fear, you don't reach these states associated with higher order thinking or higher consciousness. And so to control the population is pretty simple when you think about the masses and how easily, and look what the effect of just general living is today in our sense of security in the world. Most people live in that sense of fear and worry most of the time. When you think about more sophisticated methods, frequency following response, which I mentioned earlier, that's just where an external signal, it can be flickering light, it can be binaural beat created by the way sound enters each ear and then cancels and leaves these beat frequencies. There's some great stuff that's been written on this, but essentially we're talking about pulsed signals, and you can use electromagnetic fields lots of ways. And what happens is the brain then begins to mirror those pulse rates, and in certain frequency ranges, certain emotional states are exhibited. So moving emotional states is pretty simple. But where the military's gone with some of this is the idea of reading memory sets by taking a look at what's actually going on in a person's brain in real time, analyzing that with very high-speed computers, and being able to then generate signals to create that same thought in someone else. This work was actually funded by DARPA for the University of California a number of years ago, and it's like electronic telepathy. But they want to take it much further than where it is today.
What's amazing, too, for me is just watching how quickly social networking, when something goes viral, Nick, talk about the human mind. I mean, almost within an instant, millions and millions of people are finding something out or looking at a special video on YouTube or they're able to tweet something to each other. How does that happen so quickly with the human mind?
Well, you think about it from the standpoint of just how information flows generally. And there's this whole concept. In fact, there was a PBS special about the idea of creating the worldwide mind like you have the worldwide internet today. Now, that deserves a real serious amount of contemplation. I mean, imagine being able to have every mind linked in some similar fashion. And maybe, and this is kind of my take on it, is maybe we already do that. That's sort of our normal state, and somehow we've forgotten to, hear that. Because, I think that's fundamental to what we are as humans. But humans try and emulate the created in an interesting way. Whatever we do in science is try to kind of copy what Earth or nature or something we've observed does. It fascinates us. And the idea of mind being linked might be fascinating, but at the same time, that opens up a lot of questions about, our transparency to one another. If you think about it from that perspective, you got to be a pretty forgiving soul of yourself and everyone else if you're going to subject yourself to that level of transparency. Maybe that's Judgment Day, the day that happens, whether it be man-created or natural. I don't know. Maybe that's it.
Stick with us. Dr. Nick Begich with us. His website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. earthpulse.com, and just go up there and take a look at all the other things he has written about. We're talking about the human mind controlling it. HAARP, of course, looks like the Air Force is going to call it quits. Nick thinks probably not. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. So if you find yourself, doing some yard work, walking your dog, at the gym, stay connected to your favorite radio station. Stay connected to iHeartRadio. You can download the free app at iHeartRadio, okay? iHeartRadio in the stores, or go to iHeartRadio.com. And those of you, of course, who love apps, you've also got the CoastToCoastAM.com app. That is free for those of you with your iPhone or Androids. And don't forget our special chat tomorrow, which will be 8 p.m. Pacific time. Linda Godfrey, our guest, as she will be discussing cryptids, dogmen, and werewolves. Okay, back with Nick Begich. Nick, how easy is it to control the human mind?
Well, I think it's, there's a lot of technology that, you can look at that has that capacity. I mean, a simple light and sound devices, as an example, can cause brain entrainment, which is this, again, this frequency following response. And what it essentially utilizes is a pair of goggles that flicker at a specific rate, and a headset that sends in audio signals that create a cancellation effect and a beat frequency at the same rate. So what happens is the optic nerve carries that signal in, and the auditory nerve carries these signals in. The brain begins to modulate to these external signals, and what it does is then fall into specific sort of pre-programmed, actually really programmed, brain state. So you can go into like a light alpha state, which is where you are kind of between awake and asleep, and you're having sort of lucid sort of dreams, or you can drop into a deeper theta state and be awake or conscious at the same time. You can go to an alpha state for accelerated learning, for certain applications where you take in information and can retain it at a more efficient rate. So, I mean, or meditation, relaxation, or even getting energy raised where you're feeling a little sluggish, where you can actually create kind of a little artificial lift, if you will, by just altering the brain activity. And you can use light or sound to accomplish that. But you can also do it, if you think about advertisers and how this would work in advertising, if you want to have someone in a suggestive state where they'll take the information in more readily, and as long as not some foundational, something really different from their normal thinking, if it's just something, they'll tend to take it in and it'll be much more believable. And if you think about how people are anyway in front of a TV set, usually they're already slowed down, the brain activity slowed down. You can be hollering at them, they won't pay attention, they're almost in a light trance-like state, if you will. If you control the flicker rate and you take it down a little bit deeper, they're in a very suggestive state where just the advertiser running a normal ad, just at normal audio levels, will anchor much more profoundly than, say, if you didn't use a light oscillation. You wouldn't detect it. It would be, light enough to where it really wouldn't be noticeable unless you were really measuring for that flicker effect.
So, Nick, are good communicators, good marketeers, do they understand the human mind and they know how to go right for it?
Oh, I think some do. I mean, there's all kinds of training methods for doing that people apply, and they apparently work, or they wouldn't keep selling.
That's right.
Been there forever. But advertisers particularly, when you think about big budget advertising, that stuff has to work. When you're paying the kind of price that, big budget advertising costs, you want it to work. So you apply whatever technologies give you an advantage to make sure it works. And this is not illegal. There's no regulation against that. So, would they apply it? Yeah, I mean, every school in psychology teaches frequency following response these days. One of the other interesting ways of controlling the mind, this is kind of one of the beneficial applications, is through biofeedback, learning how to control certain aspects of the mind so you can get into certain brain states readily. For instance, kids that are hyperactive or have attention deficit disorders, instead of medicating them on pharmaceuticals, you can actually use neurobiofeedback, where you hook them up with a helmet-looking device that measures brain activity in real time, and then they get an interactive game that works off their brainwaves. So they maybe get a ball that bounces, and when they hit a certain level, it's when the brain is at the right state for ideal learning, for instance. And so with around 40, 45 sessions, you can actually train a child of 40, 45 one-hour sessions to control their brain activity at will. So you can take a kid that can't focus or concentrate, and they can actually learn how to do it, then they don't need the device anymore. They can just get there. And you think about that from a standpoint of solving a problem as opposed to medicating it for life, as is the case in a lot of these kids. This is a really excellent application of what we're learning about mind control, if you will. But it's, in this case, it's self-directed for a specific outcome. The same with a lot of things. It's what bothers me is the idea that government's spending a lot of money to figure out how to do this.
That's
and I'm
right.
Sure it's for my own good, right?
Well, remember when the government had its remote viewing program? There were a lot of people, myself included, that think that the government just didn't disband it and end it. I think they still have a program going.
Yeah, I would think so. And all of these, you know, they just change names, change locations, or change ally where we locate stuff, you know, whatever. But that's the way it works, and it always has worked that way. And when you think about mind control technologies, it goes back to the 50s and the 60s and the Church Committee in the 70s. When you look at what has been revealed, again, in the open literature for over decades, does anyone think this has gotten less? They keep letting new contracts, soliciting bids for better and better technologies, publishing in these areas. No, they haven't slowed down. They've sped up. And whatever we're reading in the open literature is probably 10 years behind where the mark is, just given the way these projects work. And I think when we talk about controlling and manipulating people, you know, whether it be propaganda for advertising or something more sophisticated, the best thinkers, okay, Zbigniew Brzezinski created one of the founders of Trilateral Commission, one of the big think tanks of the world, said, hey, it wouldn't matter who has this technology, liberal or conservative, they're going to use it because they're going to think it's in our best interest, for our own good, as they say. And this is why, when you think about big science and this kind of science in the hands of government, classified to boot, with so little oversight that even the Congress can't keep notes in these closed committee hearings, can't take staff in and can't take experts in. And we, out of 535 congressional leaders in this country, probably have less than you can count on one hand that have a decent science background to even ask the right questions. And that's the sad story, is because this is where the big money's spent and the big impact and the big risk to civil liberties and humankind in and of itself. And there's no one there asking the questions that need to be asked. And that is probably the biggest problem when you think about these high technologies today, particularly in the area of mind control and what's going to happen here. In terms of,
you know, Nick, with mind control, where do you see telepathy and intuition going?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of money's been spent there, you know, from a standpoint of government. And from a standpoint of where I think humankind is, we did a closed conference on this issue of mind control, and I was with the Lay Institute a number of years ago. And the one thing that came out of it that gets to this question is, and it shocked me, you know, you have a bunch of people around, and I'm expecting one thing. And what I got was, everyone in the room, to a person, believe the next evolution of humankind is exactly this heightening of the six senses, as we call them, you know, what we used to call extrasensory perceptions, and now they call anomalous human potentials, you know, when you read about it in military literature or elsewhere. And these are the things that I think, when you look at the mind control experiments and the stuff of the 50s and 60s, what really came out of that was the revelation that, hey, maybe all of us have this capability, and it's latent in all of us. And if it ever awakens, wouldn't that be a threat to a government that likes to be opaque and not seen? You know, and so when you think about turning the system over, that next evolution is what the system needs to survive, actually. But to hear it from physicists from various disciplines and some of the best biophysics people in the world making that comment, that's a profound way of thinking about where our consciousness goes in the 21st century, where our potential lies, and maybe these anomalous things become more of the commonplace, which changes everything about everything, I would think.
Where do you see the next 5-10 years headed with the...
Well, I think we're in for rougher times than we've seen. I tend to be an optimist, but I think we've got some things sort of headed our way as the world sort of rebalances itself. And, you know, we see a lot of panic in the West, you know, in terms of our economies and what's been happening here and sort of the effects of how government has kind of gone, you know, to a more controlled, more directed society, where other parts of the world are breaking much differently. You know, and I've had the opportunity to travel to a lot of those places. And this is a big reshuffling of the economic deck, and where the money is going is out of the organized parts of the world, Europe, the U.S., Canada. I think we're seeing certain things still happening in economic activity, but a lot of it's headed to the 6 billion people that are trying to catch up with the billion within those markets. And I think that's what we're going to see, a lot of shifting and shuffling. You know, you think about where spheres of influence are. Think about where China is today versus where they were 10, 20 years ago and where their influence is today, where Russia's gone and what they've been doing in terms of building their wealth as a nation. I mean, they're not a debtor nation. They're holding a lot of net assets. So is China. Policy, the world is changing pretty dramatically, and the third world is changing really fast. I mean, the most rapid industrial development man has ever seen is taking place in those of us who are living now in our lifetimes.
Of all the works you've done, you know, the books and the DVDs, is there a favorite of yours?
You know, actually, the one that I thought delivered the most information and sold the least, I think it maybe was the title, was Earth Rising the Revolution. Because it was intended, you know, it was pre-9/11, and it was kind of the forecast of a more directed and controlled society. So we got into sort of a cross-section of where all this was headed. And even today, people who read it today say, you know, I didn't know that stuff. And there's, you know, 650 sources. Jim Roderick and I did the research and wrote that before he passed away. And it really was the most dense compilation of material that we'd ever put together. And really, I thought it pointed in a direction. And now, 10 years, 14 years later, it's proven to be the case in so many ways. But, you know, I'm not a fatalist. I think as we move out of this period of time, we've got great potential. I mean, I think the resources are sufficient in the world for the population that lives on it. I think we can live affluent in affluent societies globally. I think there's plenty of resources. I think the way things have worked and this fabrication of shortage in much of the world, too, and the way it's been handled, I think, is more myth. You know, I live in a place in the United States that when you fly over it, it's empty space. And we're like little ants on a small hill, you know, when I think about our footprint on the earth. And I think there's a lot to be said for where the technology can serve us. And I think that's the real threshold we're on today is, does this technology serve us in the 21st century, or does it enslave us? And that's something that's a global question, because that's really fundamentally what it's about. You know, the change in economies, the change in technologies, you know, all of this, but really fundamentally, what does that do to individual liberty, freedom, the things that we say we value, and how do those fit into the 21st century? Just because we can do things, should we do it? You know, I mean, I think about personal privacy is now our digital doorway, not the front door to our house, because there's a whole lot more about us outside of our doors than ever could have existed before. And who owns the data? Should that be protected? I mean, all these things that get to fundamentally, you know, are we allowing ourselves to be a more controlled and directed society? And is that really what we want? And what are the risks when we do that in the long run? I think there's some huge risks that we still have yet to see.
Well, you know, I agree with you, too. In the long run, we're going to be okay, but it's going to be a bouncy road, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And, I mean, I really think so. And it's like this kind of a change on the planet and what we're seeing on the planet today. I mean, it's going to be a bumpy road. I would say so. We live in interesting times, however bumpy that is, because I still remain optimistic. But, yeah, I think it's going to be bumpy. I think we've got real challenges now like never before. And, you know, it's how this generation does it will decide a whole lot for the next several, for sure.
Well, I think so too, Nick. And, you know, what about a world war? Do you see that popping up at all because of all this?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think everybody's pushing to see how far they can push. And let me give you some thoughts I've had and some things I've said about this. You know, when you think about warfare and how much the U.S. spends on military, we spend, I don't know, $700 billion this year, something like this. And when you think about that amount of money and then you compare it to, say, China, that spends maybe $150 billion a year, maybe $120 billion a year, depending on whose estimate you want to read. But what do you get in China for that? This is something that most people don't really think about. They go, oh, well, it's only a little bit of money compared to this, you know. But no, it's what you get for it. In the U.S., when you build a ship, you do it in the U.S. because we have a law that says you build all U.S. ships in the U.S. in the U.S. ports. And you're paying probably $80 an hour when time you figure in benefits and overhead and the cost of running the show. In China, you might pay $7 or $8 for equivalent labor across the whole workforce building a ship. So when you start thinking about what do you get, then you really got to think about, well, what has China built in the last 20 years? And they went, you know, they go, well, they're not double, you know, digit growth anymore. They're single digit. Yeah, but they're still 7 or 8%. And it's of a lot bigger base number than it was when it was 13% on a smaller base, if you follow me. In other words, the aggregate number of dollars added to their economy is huge. They're going to equal ours in the next couple of years, which people never thought was going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, they're coming on like crazy.
Yeah, and that's just in China. You know, anything about where they've invested money, and now they're influencing a lot of Africa. There's a million Chinese living in Africa today. You know, there's a lot of change in the demographics of who influences what, and that's going to matter a lot, and it changes things. And these are governments that like to maintain absolute control. So how are they going to use this technology? I can assure you, to their advantage. You know, and everyone's developing. When you talk about mind control, it's not just the U.S. Everybody that's following the same things that everyone else has seen in the open literature has gotten the direction, and how far they've gotten is only a question of how good is their security and who knows. But certainly further than what we're seeing in the open literature, and that causes me a lot of concern.
Nick, what do you think of chemtrails?
You know, I followed that story, you know, on and off, and when it first came out, there was so much bad science because people were pulling samples off the ground, you know, not where they needed to be taken from, and there was a lot of speculation. And I kind of stayed away from it. But the thing that I did know is that, you know, 9/11 proved this older theory, and we mentioned it in Angels, actually. And it was this idea that you could add to cumulus cloud formation, and by just in terms of jet streams naturally coming off of the exhaust of jets. And what it essentially did is that exhaust would add to cumulus cloud formation and create increased storm fronts. And it was a theory at the time. Mm-hmm. But in 9/11, when they actually shut down all the airspace virtually, they were able to run those models and prove it not as a theory but as a scientific fact. So from that perspective, you know, yeah, I can see some, you know, even experimentally. But if you just think about the increase in air traffic from what it was even 30, 40 years ago. I mean, you chart that curve and it's going almost off the charts. If you think about global air traffic as all these world economies have started to move, you know, by big leaps and bounds, that has added a lot to that whole equation of what's causing what problems. You know, satellite launches in terms of ozone depletion, a bunch of things that aren't being fully attributed to their root causes. And I think that's what we're seeing in some of this as well. And the rest of it, are they spraying? Well, there's history of them doing this from time to time. But again, the sampling that's going on was always sketchy to me because it should be sampled at the point of discharge as close to it as you can, along with background air samples to make sure there's just not something in the natural background. Because like a lot of these places where like high aluminum content was being reported happened to be where
it was there. They saw it.
Yeah, yeah. So you got to kind of look at each one of these because there were lots of different reports with varying levels of evidence, I guess. And that was the problem for me on it. You know, there was so much maybe disinformation associated with that story as I tried to piece parts of it together. And others were moving forward on it. Let them move forward on it. But I didn't see a lot of the HAARP connections that people were asserting because they were unnecessary. You know, the idea of metal fragments or things in the atmosphere to trigger with HAARP. You could create some interesting effects, certainly, but was it necessary? I don't know.
All right, Nick, we're going to come back. We're going to take phone calls with you as we talk about mind control and HAARP on Coast to Coast AM.